This is the Technology Evangelist with Scott Schweitzer, and thank you for listening. Today's show is brought to you by Solarflare. In March, Solarflare is releasing their X2 line of secure 10 and 25 gigabit Ethernet NICs in both PCIe and OCP form factors. Unlike other performance NICs, this line is tamper-resistant and includes free line rate packet filtering and OS kernel bypass. To learn more, please visit solarflare.com. This is the Technology Evangelist. Today we're with Bob Van Valza, and we're talking about blockchains and digital currencies. So, Bob, how did you get started in the whole blockchain digital currency space?
Well, Scott, I listened to a podcast. Actually, the podcast was called Security Now. Great podcast, and it covers a lot of aspects of security. And in the summer of 2010, they covered this new thing called Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is built on this blockchain technology that we'll talk about tonight. And, you know, I was interested on the security and cryptography side, and a little bit interested in the monetary side, I suppose. But it was certainly novel that someone had, you know, done what they claimed to be doing with Bitcoin. And then the price went from, you know, under $1 to almost $30 in the summer of 2011, so a year after I'd learned about it. And in the meantime, I'd mentioned it to my son, and he got started doing this thing called mining. And then I started mining in 2011 because it seemed like, you know, the price was going back up. And it quickly fell below $10 and stayed below $10 for the next year. So I stopped mining in 2013 because about that time I went to work for Sun Trading, and they're a registered broker dealer. And it, you know, it really, they're heavily regulated, and it made sense for them, and it made sense for me just to stop doing anything that could have any outside interest. So I just stopped, which is fine. I'm glad I did. But recently, price of Bitcoin has been up to $5,000 almost. And then tonight it's back down to $3,300. So
a little vol.
It's a pretty wild ride. Yeah, very vol.
All right. So are
anyway,
you still,
so that's,
are you still mining Bitcoin?
No. I stopped in 2013. For many reasons, we can talk about the advances of technology, but essentially it requires continued expense and effort to stay current on mining. So I stopped.
Understood. So, you know, what is the whole concept behind Bitcoin? It's this thing called a blockchain. What are blockchains good for other than Bitcoins?
Yeah, so you can make digital currencies out of these things. And Bitcoin is an example of a digital currency. Another one you might have heard of is called Ethereum. It's getting a lot of press recently.
Right.
And these things are a bit like normal currency money, but they're different. And we can talk about that later on. But maybe a couple of other interesting things you can do with this blockchain technology. If you don't want to make a digital currency, you can make what you might call a public ledger. So examples of public ledgers would be who owns how much property in Chicago, Illinois. That's a matter of public record. You know, who owns license plate XYZ123 in the state of Illinois, right, where I live. These are just public ledgers that need to be maintained somehow. There's a thing called smart contracts. We won't go into detail tonight, but imagine a contract that not only laid out the terms of the contract, but also executed those terms, a contract with effectively computer code built right in.
Okay.
And maybe one of the most interesting things is the phenomenon that's been in the news a lot recently called an initial coin offering, ICO, as contrasted with an initial public offering like you'd normally have for stocks. These are really far-fetched things that we can talk about later after we get some of the basic blockchain technology out of the way. But I think if we don't talk about blockchain technology first, then all this other crazy stuff will just seem impossible. And when we're explaining like how it's actually all the things that it can do, you'll be stuck on, you know, trying to understand how it's even possible and lose all the cool things that it can do.
Yeah, I've seen that recently IBM has spun up a group to focus on blockchain and all the different uses and applications for it in the industry. So it should be interesting to see how this takes off. So can you go over a little bit about how blockchain is structured?
Well, sure. So the first piece, Scott, is the notion of what's a block, right? Well, a block in the case of digital currencies and almost all these things is really just a list of transactions. So it isn't just a single person transaction, not like Bob paid Scott, you know, $1 or one Bitcoin or Scott paid Bob. But it's more sort of like a poker game. So if you matter the results of a poker game in the sense that there's nothing, you know, random, there's no dealing of cards. But if you think about a poker game with 10 guys coming to a table, there's going to be between 1 and 9 winners and between 1 and 9 losers. And you can think of it as though they put all their money in the table and then the game happens and then they take the money off the table. And so there's some list of people who end up with less money and some list of people who end up with more money. And one transaction that goes into a block simply has a list of the losers and a list of the winners, if you use the poker game metaphor. But in fact, the terminology in the blockchain is that there's a list of accounts, if you will, accounts from which money is taken. That makes up a total pool of money, like the pot and the money in the middle of the table. And there's a list of accounts to which money is sent. That's one or more places where the results of all those incomes go. So you have a list of people contributing to the transaction and the people taking money out of the transaction. That's what you get. That's the block part of a blockchain. So the chain part essentially says, now if we've got, say, 100 transactions grouped into a block, we have to somehow link that to the next group of 100 transactions, the next block. And of course, all this starts, like any good chain, there has to be an initial block, which was called the Genesis block, which got the whole process started. But now every day, turns out in the case of Bitcoin, once every 10 minutes, one new block is added to the blockchain. And that's why it's called blockchain technology.
So now, are these blockchains, going back to my computer science degree, are these like double link lists?
A bit, yeah. Yeah, yeah. There's at least a forward pointer. I'm not sure if there's a backward pointer, but double link lists are more a structure in memory, and the blockchain is more of a conceptual thing. Of course, it can be rendered in memory.
So, okay, so now I've got a blockchain. Where do we actually keep this blockchain?
Well, so the blockchains are kept on computers, not surprisingly. There have to be computers connected to the internet to make a blockchain. There are examples of what are called private blockchains. You mentioned IBM. I'm sure inside IBM's got some blockchains we can't see. And several of the major banks are trying to create blockchains that are private to the bank. But Bitcoin in particular and many of the more interesting applications of blockchain are inherently public. So these are just computers connected to the internet, and these computers are called nodes. So the blockchain itself is stored on some set of nodes. I think when I last looked, there were several thousand nodes running the Bitcoin blockchain. Okay. And in fact, I have one sitting right here. I can reach out and touch it in my office. It's not a particularly big thing. It's just actually a compact PC, an Intel Nook, it's called. And it only has a 256 gig SSD in it, and that's enough to store the entire Bitcoin blockchain.
Okay, so what does this node actually do computationally? What's its purpose?
Well, there's really several different things the node does. One is, you know, it uses its memory and it uses that 256 gig hard disk to maintain a full list of the entire blockchain. So every block is there available to my node and every other node on the network. And one of the important things about these nodes is they all 20,000 nodes or whatever it is, they aren't all in my office, obviously. So there's one here in Wheaton, Illinois, where I live. There's probably maybe a few others in Wheaton, Illinois, and certainly there's hundreds or thousands in Chicago, and they're spread around the world. So one of the beauties of having it distributed in this way is that it's harder to attack. If somebody comes into my house with a gun and says, "Hand over your blockchain," well, I'll give it to them, but that won't hurt. That won't hurt anybody else. There'll still be 19,999 other guys with complete copies of the blockchain. So it's very hard to shut down when it's distributed to all these places. So each node has an important role in being just one more copy of the blockchain, which makes it harder to attack and more robust. So that's the first key thing that every node does. Another key thing that nodes do is sort of take a list of pending transactions and form them into these blocks. So what defines the boundary between blocks is a distributed process carried out among the nodes. So the nodes look at everybody, like if I pay you and, you know, Alice pays Mary and, you know, all of these things are transactions that are vying to be part of the blockchain. And the nodes as a group figure out which transactions are packed into the next block and which are waiting for the block after that. So that's the second key thing that each node does, or the group, the nodes as a whole do that function. And then, in effect, to understand all the many of the benefits that come from this, each of the nodes that is mining, and we'll talk about what that is in a minute, but the miners are competing with all the other miners. So they're competing to extend the blockchain, to come up with the next block, which will be added to the chain. And that competition is what gives rise to this mining phenomenon we'll talk about soon. And the point of competing is that when you win the privilege of extending the blockchain, adding the next block to it, you get paid. So you have an incentive to do that, and we'll define how the paying works later on. So the nodes which are miners are competing to extend the blockchain. They get paid when they succeed. And then they very quickly, you know, want to start over again if they lose a particular block and start working on the next block. Finally, the last important thing we'll come back to is that each of the nodes is connected to a handful of other nodes. I think mine is connected to like 8 other nodes right now. And that provides a way for all the nodes to talk to each other, much like the routers in a network. You know, so a solar flare NIC would be connected to one switch or router, but that in turn would be connected to lots of others that let it reach any node on the network. And in the same way, the nodes which make up the distributed blockchain network are all able to talk to each other, although it may take several hops to get there.
Okay, is there a name for that collection of 8 or 12 nodes?
Neighbors, I think. Neighbors, okay. They're just each node's neighbors. I think that's what.
So now those neighbors aren't necessarily competing for each other. They're competing as a team against other teams for the mining?
I think it's essentially every miner for himself. Okay. And we can talk about the.
That's fine.
But there's nothing special about the. It's actually random which nodes you get connected to. So if I lose power here and come back up, I might be connected to completely different guys.
Are all the nodes miners? What's the difference between a mining node and then more generic
just node? A regular node just keeps the history and maintains the connections and things like that, but doesn't enter into the competition. They just, in effect, they hold the data, but don't try and add a new block. The mining nodes not only hold the entire history, but they also are racing, as I've said, to be the next guy who extends the block.
So those guys are like another distributed ledger copy.
Yes, they're another copy, but consuming all the power and doing all the hard work and getting paid for it.
Well, no, I'm talking about the distributed nodes, the ones like the ones sitting in your office there, the small PC.
I mean, I have it here because I like having the blockchain around. I like adding a little bit of history to it, but I also keep a thing called a Bitcoin wallet on there, so I can spend money through it. I can send a transaction into the network through my own node. Most people don't need to do that. They would just use a website which has a node connected to it, which would send it into the network. So.
Okay, so the next obvious question is a miner a person or a thing? I think you've kind of already alluded to the fact that that's some sort of specialized computer. Why don't you go into what that is?
Yeah, I've been a little loose with the technology, and I'll say a little more here. So let's define a thing called a mining rig, which is literally a specialized computer. In the beginning, it was computers that had GPUs or graphics processing units, and it sort of went on from there. And then I'll try and talk about a mining rig when I mean the hardware, which is actually doing the mining. And it's the work of that hardware that's competing with all the other hardworking hardware. And then a miner, such as, back when I was mining, a miner such as myself, is a person, we'll say, who's just operating one or more mining rigs. That person doesn't care if it's rig A, B, or C that wins. He, gets the results of the collective effort of all his mining rigs.
Right. And a mining rig is really just a collection of mining nodes together.
Well, in the very early days, it was just a regular old Pentium computer, Core i7 or whatever, and before we had GPUs. So it's just a computer running special software.
Okay. So what does one look like today then?
Yeah, there's been a few nice pictorials. I'm sure you can go to Google Images and put in mining rig and find all kinds of things. But the smaller things are, the size of a paperback book, I suppose, and plug into lots of wires and then plug into an Ethernet, connect to the Internet. The larger things are literally racks of super specialized stuff in buildings that are located near hydroelectric power sources so that you get cheap electricity. And, that's the industrial scale mining that you see in China and a few other places.
Yeah, I looked into this a little while back. And they have these calculators online now where you put in what your electricity costs, how much your mining rig costs, and what the computational power of your mining rig is, and they forecast roughly how much per unit of time you're going to make.
Yep. That was one of the challenges when I was doing it, was that there was no easy place to do that, so you had to kind of get out a back of an envelope and work that out for yourself.
So now, from what I've heard, they actually have some special purpose chips, ASICs. That accelerate this mining process. They've gone beyond GPUs and FPGAs?
Yes, way beyond. And so in the same way that Intel and AMD are racing to build the next fastest microprocessor for your notebook or your server, the companies who make mining chips are racing against each other to produce chips that do more mining work and consume less power, very much like Intel and AMD are working to do, you know, CPUs that can compute web pages faster and consume less battery power in the process. So it's the same underlying technology. Moore's Law is driving both.
How amazing. Now, what are the miners actually competing to do? What is it that they're, you know, racing to solve?
Yeah, it's really the simplest way to explain it, Scott, is a puzzle. Think of it as with each stage in the growth of the blockchain, there's a quest to extend the blockchain to add the next block. And that puzzle is a special kind of mathematical puzzle. And it's designed in such a way that even if you know everything there is to know about the puzzle, you cannot get to the answer, the solution to the puzzle, through any means other than guessing. There's no amount of math you can do to sort of compute an answer. The only thing you can do is guess and say, do I have the right one this time? And guess again, do I have the right one that time? And you should keep track of your past guesses. And when you've been told no, don't repeat that guess. But other than just what's called brute forcing in math.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, just nothing else to do. And the term here is in cryptography is called hashing, which just means you take a bunch of information, letters, you could think of them, you scramble them all up and produce a fixed size result. And that's what's really behind all this complicated math we don't need to talk about. But to just put some scope, to give you a feel for how much work there is that's going on, each of these hashes is an enormously complex operation with like 1,500 multiplies and adds going on in each one. And there's 8 million, million, million of those hashes happening every second.
Well, that's right, a trivial little number.
Yeah, that's a lot. 10 to the 18th power.
Yeah, just give me a legal pad and a pencil. And
you'll step right up.
500 lifetimes, I'll get through one hash.
Yeah, it's a hard problem. But that's okay. It's been designed to be a problem that you just have to guess and brute force your way through. And it's a special area of math that has this property. And it turns out to be a very useful property. We can talk about some of the reasons for that. If this is all confusing, probably the easiest way to think of it is if you visualize a Rubik's Cube, or if you visualize, they were popular when I was a kid, it's a little flat square thing with sliding tiles, and there was room for 16 tiles, right. And the tiles had the numbers 1 through 15, and there was one blank space. And if you take either the Rubik's Cube or that sliding square puzzle, it's very easy to look at one if somebody just hands it one to you and say, this is a solved Rubik's Cube, or it's a scrambled Rubik's Cube, or this is a square puzzle in order 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 15, or this one's needs work. It's clearly not solved yet. Okay. So just with a very short glance, even a 4-year-old literally can look at either one of those puzzles with no idea how to solve it and yet say it is solved or it is not. And that's key to this whole class of mathematical problems, which are very easy to test and see if the puzzle has been solved or if it hasn't. And you can think of yourself sort of like a 4-year-old, you know, even though you're smart, you're not a 4-year-old. The puzzle has been designed in such a way that you cannot know you've got it solved until you just try a solution and look at it and go, ah, this is the one solution that works. You have to like stumble on the solution to a Rubik's Cube. You can't, you know, come up with a plan for how to take scrambled Rubik's Cubes and turn them into solved Rubik's Cubes. You just have to keep trying until you get it right with this whole class of puzzles.
So this class of puzzles, are we looking for like primes in a huge field of numbers, or is this something different than that?
It is different. Primes and huge fields of numbers do come in on the cryptography side, but the puzzles are just called a proof of work puzzle. And Essentially what you're looking for are zero bits at the end of a hash. Right. So if you imagine a hash is going to be random zeros and ones if it's a well-designed hash, and the hashes here are well-designed. So imagine that what you have to do is this complex operation. What comes out is literally 256 random zeros and ones, and you haven't solved the puzzle until you get 130 zeros in a row at the end.
Wow.
It's extremely hard.
2 to the 130, that's a small number.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
We're just dealing big numbers tonight.
Yes, we
okay,
are.
so how about the efficiency here? How does efficiency fit into all
Yeah.
the whole puzzle solving?
Well, so at one level, the miners are competing to extend the blockchain, and it's just, winner take all, first one wins the next block. That's great. But if you back up a step and say, what are they really competing to do? They're competing to do that job. They're competing to win, and they're competing to win efficiently. So it costs money to play at this poker table
Right.
or pull the lever on the slot machine, whatever analogy you want to use. It takes energy, literally electricity, to run mining rigs. The rigs I had in my basement used about as much energy as three hair dryers on high speed. So, 4 kilowatts roughly.
And it's a reasonable amount.
Yeah, it made my electric meter spin pretty darn fast. You open the basement door and you got a blast of hot air coming up the stairs at you because
I'm
with
sure
all the
your wife
heat that
loved
we.
it.
Oh yeah, well, it was okay in the winter, but not so great in the summer. Anyway,
There you go.
you're competing to solve these puzzles quickly, but you're also competing to solve these puzzles with the least amount of dollars expended. So that you can, get yourself paid back before you run out of money.
Right. Well, if you were mining a bunch when it was $10 and now it's $500 or $5,000, you actually probably did pretty good.
Yeah, but of course, it's all the time we were mining. We had no idea what the future would be, just sort of hoping.
Yeah, right. Well, we've seen what it's been the last few weeks. We're bouncing between 3,000 and 5,000
It's a lot of bouncing.
dollars per Bitcoin. Okay, so
Yes.
the miners are obviously all racing to extend the blockchain, but who decides, which miner is going to win? How is this process designed?
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting things about it, I think, Scott, because if you think of it like a race, and there is a finish line, even in a case of a photo finish, you can tell if there's, two or three runners who are close, there's always somebody's nose who goes over the finish line first. But in order to do that, there has to be a finish line. And remember that these miners who are competing are all over the world, right? So there's guys in China mining, there's guys in Chicago mining. How do you know who won? Well, this process is baked into all of the nodes, and it's the way it's done is that as soon all the miners are working to solve this puzzle, the current puzzle, and as soon as somebody discovers that their, in effect, roll of the random dice has led to a correct solution, they just their Rubik's cube is perfectly solved. What they do is shout as quickly as possible to their neighbors, "I've solved it! I've solved it! And here's my answer." And they, in fact, send a copy of their Rubik's cube to the neighbor, and the neighbor looks at it and says, "Oh, maybe he's making something up, and he doesn't really have a solution." That doesn't happen. You get yourself kicked out pretty quickly if you do that. Or the neighbor looks at it and says, "Wow, I hate to admit it, but you've solved the problem. I'll tell my neighbors you've solved the problem." And he in turn looks at it and goes, "Wow, this is a good solution. I'll tell my neighbors that he's solved the problem." And because the farthest two nodes can talk to each other through all the intermediate nodes in literally fractions of a second, and because it takes 10 minutes to create a new block by design, you very quickly get the news spread to all the nodes that someone somewhere, one of the miners, has won the current race to extend the blockchain. There is a new block. Everybody gets a copy of that new block, and now they go on to do the next one.
So then the obvious question is, what happens when two miners find the same solution at the same time or within that finite window that exists during
Yeah.
the time of the flood?
Well, there's a subtle point here that essentially every miner's solution is unique. He sort of starts with his own miner ID, if you will. So it's impossible for two miners to end up with exactly the same solution. But the larger question that's more interesting is sort of what if two miners each find a valid solution, that's based on their own unique ID. And that can happen. It does happen maybe a few times a day, but it doesn't really happen a lot. But the way that is resolved is the miners are racing to find a solution. And if two of them find it within a fraction of a second of each other, they both start broadcasting to their neighbor nodes as quickly as they can. And the way the math in the system works out is that one of those two will reach 50% of the total network of nodes before the other guy does. And from there, it's all downhill.
I would right? guess. Yeah, right.
Yeah, so if you're the lucky guy who reaches 8 people who reach, 64 people who reach 65,000 people or whatever, right? Now, if you happen to be there and just get over the 50% mark, then, you don't want to be the guy who has 49% going, well, it was 49%, but sorry, the other guy got the 50 before you did, and we're all going with him because he beat you to 50%.
Okay, well, that makes sense. So obviously these collisions don't happen often because you've got this 50% rule for resolving this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it's the ratio of the network propagation time to the block generation time. So it's fractions of a second to 10 minutes, which is a pretty good odds that somebody will win cleanly, let's say, rather than having a contended win.
So now, as the technology and the ASICs get faster and the compute time, the number of hashes per second increases, and the ability to generate, these guesses goes up, mm-hmm. has the whole blockchain concept shrunken to less than 10 minutes, or is it still a fixed one block every 10 minutes?
Well, in the case of Bitcoin, it is still one block every 10 minutes, even though, I could look up the actual numbers, but it's got to be at least tens of thousands, if not millions of times faster today at guessing. The network as a whole is guessing, we'll call it millions or billions of times faster than it used to. So the way to think of it is that the puzzles are tuned to the skill of the people solving the puzzle. And this is by design through all the nodes. All the nodes sort of keep track of how fast the guesses are coming in. And every couple of weeks, the difficulty of the puzzle is adjusted for the number of participants racing to find a solution. And the goal of this adjustment is to keep the rate of a winner about once every 10 minutes. So that's how the system is sort of self-regulating. And in fact, if more miners come to the party and attempt to solve the puzzle gets harder. And if maybe the cost of electricity goes up or the North Koreans blow somebody up and there's fear and doubt and people stop mining, who knows what it might be. If people decide it's not worth mining anymore, then the difficulty gets easier. And that means the solutions still come every 10 minutes. So it's taken care of itself for 7 years since 2010 when it started and stayed pretty much right on 10 minutes the whole time.
What happens if a solution takes longer than 10 minutes? Is there a problem with that?
No, not at all. In fact, it's really a random process is the way to think of it, right? It's sort of the average works out to be 10 minutes, but there have been the longest time between blocks has probably been a better part of an hour, I would guess, or maybe a lot longer, just when, the random dice fell that way.
Okay, so, with all this generation of blocks in the blockchain, and clearly there's a lot of money involved here, what keeps the bad guys from, figuring out how to circumvent the system?
Well, so I guess there's maybe two questions there. Let's say there's the question of an internal bad guy. One of the miners wants to cause harm to the overall system. And then we'll talk about maybe external bad guys in a minute. So the first thing to think about is a miner who was, let's just say, grumpy that, he lost another round to somebody else, right? His best strategy going forward is not to sit around and be grumpy. It's to just jump right back in and start competing on the next block.
Right.
So each miner has an incentive to sort of get over the emotional angst, if silicon could have emotional angst, and just start computing the next block. It's just a natural consequence of the way the network is built. And later on, we can talk about some attacks from the outside. If bad guys wanted to do stuff, if you want to do that.
So when you were mining back in 2010, how often did you win the block or solve the puzzle?
Yeah, so very early on, before I started, miners were effectively competing to win the whole block as individuals. But about the time I got into it, essentially, you would have to compete with a lot of equipment for months to win. And what that meant was your incentive was to bind together with other miners into what was called a mining pool. and you would each put some amount of effort into winning. And when your pool, when one of you won, then the pool's job would be to redistribute the winnings proportionally to the amount of shares you'd put in, the number of puzzles you'd guessed, even though they were wrong. You still got paid for your effort of doing the wrong guesses. So that means you'd get paid fractions of a Bitcoin when the group won a single Bitcoin. So that's, gotcha. That's how it worked.
How is the blockchain itself different than a standard banking type ledger?
Well, it's similar in a lot of ways. So we can focus on the differences. The, you know, every bank has a ledger of, you know, my balance, your balance. You know, if I have three accounts, they've got a balance for each of those. But if you think about a branch of a bank, right, you know, so suppose my bank has 10 branches, the bank has to be careful that, you know, if I have $100 in my account, I can't walk up to the ATM at the first branch, take out $100, and then drive over to the second branch and take out $100 again, because my account has zero balance after the first withdrawal.
Right.
So even though it's a distributed bank, it's really kind of a centralized ledger, or at least ledgers that are kept in sync. And blockchain technology is closer to that distributed but synchronized world. And in fact, this whole process of mining and the neighbors that we talked about is the mechanism through which the blocks get propagated from node to node and spread throughout. So it is a distributed ledger. That's kind of the key thing. It's similar, but the primary difference is that the blockchain technology keeps each copy of the ledger safe and secure and consistent. They're all the same. So the blocks that are on my little PC here next to me are the same as the blocks that are on everybody else's.
And now banking is all about trust, right? So, yes. You know, why is the trust of a distributed ledger like that of a blockchain different or better than the trust of, you know, say my, you know, Citibank bank account?
Well, there's a few reasons. One is, you know, we're recording this at a time when, you know, a credit reporting agency got hacked. They had a centralized database or maybe copies of a distributed database, and it was compromised and it was all gone. In the case of a bank, you know, the bank may have cash and the robbers, you know, can come up with guns and point them at the tellers and take some of the cash. Criminals could hack into the computers at a bank and take a copy of the ledger and, you know, maybe transfer some money out. But we have enough mechanisms through, you know, federal deposit insurance and all these sorts of things and money transfer logs that, you know, banks should discover it pretty quickly if bad guys are inside. So the banks have earned their trust. There's no denying that. And it's a fine place to keep U.S. dollars if you live in the U.S., right? I don't think the banks have a monopoly on trust. Maybe a good way to say it. And one way to look at it is that what humans have done with their brain power over time, you know, money's not a particularly new invention. It's been around a long time. Banks, even, you know, on a slightly different time scale, are not a particularly new invention. Another time scale, they are quite new. I mean, banks have only been around a few hundred years, I think, in the form we know of today. And in some ways, what we've done with at least the cryptocurrency applications of a blockchain, we've used technology to build a new vehicle for trust, a ledger which will keep track of your balance and my balance and everybody else's balance, in a way that we all agree is trustworthy. And that, you know, why does anybody still balance their check account statement? Well, I do, but I will admit that it's at least partially out of habit and to make sure that I'm not surprised. Right. You know, but I don't find errors when I, you know, balance my checking account. If something's wrong, it's because I've screwed up, not because the bank has screwed up. They're trustworthy. And in the same way, I think blockchain technology has proven itself. It's only been 7 years, right? So it hasn't been like 70 years or 700 years of bank technology. But I think we'll find that the underlying technology that allows a blockchain to be distributed in this way is very hard to attack and is worthy of our trust.
And now I read somewhere that the Bitcoin market cap is $65
billion. Yes. So
how is that fixed?
Well, it's not fixed. So there's some number of Bitcoins out there, and I want to save the details of Bitcoin for another time. The key thing let's look at on that number, let's take that number back to trust, right? Because if you said to me that this whole Bitcoin thing was, you know, it's just a bunch of, you know, bearded hippies or young hackers or something like that, it's just an experiment, right? And maybe it's only worth a few $1,000. It's if it's small potatoes, it's not worth attacking. If you're a talented hacker, you'd rather go attack a credit reporting agency and get something you can sell. You'd rather attack a bank and steal some money, right? But so let's get back to that number. If it is $65 billion in market capitalization and you can find a flaw in the Bitcoin software or the whole idea of a blockchain, if you're just a mathematician who stands there at a chalkboard, you know, or a whiteboard and squirts equations on the board all day, and you go, woohoo, this crypto stuff, I found a hole in it. You can just, you know, if that were possible, you could figure out how to spend somebody else's $65 million.
Right.
So another way to look at this is that the existence of a trust mechanism that is able to hold $65 billion worth of trust is it's been able to do that so far, you know, through the end of tonight as we're recording this. This is a good indicator that they'll be able to do it again tomorrow, because people are working hard to attack it, and they wouldn't be if it had a little tiny market cap. So it's in effect a bounty, a bug bounty is what the programmers would call it. If you can find a bug, you can steal $65 billion.
There you go. That's a good incentive, I would think.
Yeah.
Okay, so all the transactions then that are stuffed into the block to form the blockchain, these were all digitally signed by, you know, all the sources, all the nodes within the blockchain. How's that actually work?
So at the heart of everything that goes on with this, the reason it's called cryptocurrency is because it uses what's called public key cryptography. And we won't go into the whole math behind that, but the beauty of public key cryptography is that it can be used for digital signatures. It's one of its beauties. And the idea of a public key cryptography system is that you, as a participant in the system, have your keys to the system split into two halves. And those two halves are called your public key and your private key. And your public key is, in effect, like your login name or your email address on a computer system. It's a unique thing about you. There's nobody else with that name. And it can be your destination address. Someone can send you mail, you know, to your email address. And they don't need to know your password to send you that mail. And you do need to know the password to receive that mail. In the same way that password on an email account is roughly like the private key that goes with the public key, which would be like your username.
Right.
So the public key cryptography lets you sort of split the key into two pieces, public and private, and that's good stuff. The way this is used with blockchain technology is that someone who wants to add a transaction to the chain, right? In effect, you could think of it as a loser at the poker game, someone who's spending money, needs to use their private key to sign a transaction and say, I want to have less money on my ledger, and here's the amount I'm willing to give up from my ledger, and here's the public key of the guy I want it to go to. And off it goes. That's really all you need to do. And that transaction is signed by your private key, so anybody can look at it and go, well, gosh, there's, you know, it came from Bob, and it's got a correct signature. He must want to give money to Scott. And it happens just that easily. So there's no need for an intermediary. There's no bank that it has to go through. There's nobody else who has to look at it and approve it, because it's apparent to everybody on the network through this magic of this public key cryptography that it is the transaction I wanted to do. And it's written down in every single node, and they can all check it for its accuracy and avoid me like spending below zero. Nobody's going to let me, which it goes back to the ATM trick. You can't pull $100 out of the ATM at every branch, you know, because my transaction balance, or my ledger balance, is the same on every blockchain copy everywhere.
So then how does the system know that my signature is a valid signature?
Well, this is more details of the math that I frankly don't understand. And even if I did understand them, I probably couldn't explain them well. But you can think of it sort of like a checksum on a packet.
Okay.
You can look at a sign to the signature with knowledge of the public key of the signer and say, well, by golly, you know, he managed to pull it off. I don't know how he did it. He must know the private key. I can tell it's a valid signature, and this must be the amount he wants to spend.
So now, I had seen a documentary recently on the whole blockchain, you know, Bitcoin stuff on Netflix, and they mentioned this guy, Satoshi Nakamoto, and there was a whole mystery around who Satoshi Nakamoto is, the guy that invented blockchains. Can you go into that a little bit?
Sure. So I'll put it as though there's a name we have, because the idea, there was one technical paper written, not a terribly long technical paper, it's like 7 or 8 pages, if I remember right. And it's very well written. And the name on the paper is the author of the paper is Satoshi Nakamoto. And he laid out the idea of blockchain technology and specifically the application of blockchain technology to cryptocurrency. And that became Bitcoin. The Bitcoin software was implemented from the design laid out by Satoshi Nakamoto. But it was very clear from the beginning that this name might be a real person, or it might not be. It could be one person's pen name, or it could be a group of people who assumed this name as a group, you know, a bunch of crypto experts or government money haters, you know, for whatever reason they had to think about. Or you know, another, it could be bank haters, right? Because as you point out, in many ways, what this blockchain technology does is it disrupts the monopoly on trust that our banks have, right? Or it disrupts the monopoly that our governments have on creating currency. So whatever the motive was, we have this technical paper another way to think of it is this technical paper defines an invention, right? Because this guy or group of guys sat down, rubbed their chins, scratched their heads, and said, wow, we could make something that was a lot like money and it would be trustworthy. Right. And, you know, they would have a lot of these interesting properties and they described how to do it. And then a few days later, source code popped up on the internet, which did this, the Bitcoin software just, you know, in effect, not quite literally popped up. But again, a guy named Satoshi Nakamoto comes on the internet and says, I've written this software. Take it for a spin. See what you think. And that's how the first few nodes of, you know, and of course he had the Genesis block and started this all up. So we don't really know. We know that nobody has stood up and volunteered and said, I am Satoshi Nakamoto. There have been a few investigative journalists who have claimed they found someone and far more investigative journalists who have tried and failed to find anybody. But the key thing to understand is that whoever it is has probably a million bitcoins, which were the very first million created back in 2009 or 10 at the very beginning when you couldn't even turn them into a dollar if you wanted to. There were no exchanges at the time. But so there's somebody sitting on a million bitcoins, which would be $5 billion at the peak and even, you know, 30, you know, wherever the heck it is, $3 billion as I look at the value right now. So there's somebody or a group of people who are billionaires and they have not been spending this money. We know from the history, we can see the transactions. We know the public key of the group who created those first blocks, and they have not been spent. They're just still sitting there on the blockchain.
In the documentary, they actually mentioned that early on, after the guy posted the source code for this to get it rolling, that he had an email address and he was responding to queries very tersely, but it was in a consistent singular voice. And they were wondering if they kind of postulated that it really was one guy, but no one can figure out who this individual is.
Yep. Yep. It could be the governments know, and nobody's talking. It's all speculation. I'd love to know who it is, but on the other hand, I have to say number one, I admire the intellectual achievement here. I mean, this is
the world
really
stuff.
Yeah, it is. And especially if it's one guy who, you know, looked at the technology around him and said, if we put this cryptography together with this, you know, distributed ledger stuff, we could make something really useful, right? And he described how to do it. And then he wrote the source code to do it, right? You know, that's a pretty substantial intellectual achievement. So I you know, if he wants his privacy, okay, you earned it, buddy.
So now that we know the foundational technology underneath digital currencies, namely blockchains, you know, where do we go from here?
We teased that a little bit at the beginning, talking about there's a lot more to talk about on digital currencies and, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum, all these sorts of things, and these smart contracts and all this other stuff. And another way to think of it is that, you know, the technology of the internal combustion engine, when it was invented, you know, we could see pretty much right away how to use that to replace a horse. You know, and the first few decades of internal combustion engines, they were just busy replacing horses. And, you know, before we even had cars made out of internal combustion engines, they were replacing, you know, tractors and horses and things like that. And in some ways, blockchain technology may be like that. It's just the very first few uses have popped out, offering an alternative means of trust to a bank. So distributed ledger technology, blockchain technology, writes down a list of transactions and does that in a robust way where there's many copies of the ledger. And because it's many copies of it, it's very hard to attack. And so far, it's been unhackable. Nobody who has tried has figured out how to take money out of it that isn't intended to be transferred. So it's a way to permanently write things down and have them available for everyone to see. And the work of writing down those transactions, we said, was done by guys who were called miners. And they have expensive equipment, and they get paid for the work of doing that. This is called signing the transactions, and that's extending the chain of blocks, which contain the transactions. So you end up with this many copies of a perfect record of where the money went and who it came from and who it went to in a way that it can't be lost. There'll always be a record of all the transactions on the blockchain.
We hear folks talking about fiat currencies. Can you give us some background on what a fiat currency is?
Sure. So fiat currencies are really the alternative for the average person to Bitcoin. And it's the money you use every day. So in some ways, explaining what fiat currencies are is like explaining what water is to a fish. It's important because so much of what we take for granted about the money we use every day is, well, exactly taken for granted. So the key question you have to ask about the dollar bill you hold in your hand is, where does the value come from? You don't think of that because you've either worked to earn the dollar bill or you got the dollar bill, you found it on the sidewalk. It's not worth a dollar because you can get a dollar's worth of heat when you burn it. And it's not worth a dollar because you can put the dollar bill into your gas tank and drive your car. You can use it to buy gasoline for the car. You can use it to buy natural gas to heat your home. But the paper itself is really worth nothing. And the ink and the printing and all that makes it worth a little more, but it's still just a nicely decorated piece of paper. It has value far more than its cost of the paper and the ink and the printing because our government says this is worth a dollar. And the other side of that is because when you hand that dollar bill to the guy at the gas station or the natural gas company, you know, when you buy energy with that dollar bill, that person can turn around and spend it to buy a gallon of milk or whatever is important to them, eggs, you know. So its value comes not from the properties of the paper or, you know, in the old days it did when we had gold coins and silver coins and things like that. But since we've gone off that, metals-based money systems, now we're on what are called representative money systems, and the value is coming from just the government saying by fiat, you know, we say this is worth a dollar, so it is. And the other thing the government gets to say about this kind of money is that it's a requirement that you pay your taxes using this kind of money. So you have to pay your taxes in dollars. You can't pay them in Bitcoin. And but by the same token, you can't pay your U.S. taxes in, you know, with Japanese yen. You have to use U.S. dollars to pay your U.S. taxes. So it's not very novel in that regard. So fiat money in general is just money where the value comes from the government saying that it has value, and therefore all the citizenry accepts the, you know, the representation, whether it's paper or coin or whatever, is having value because it does. You can use it every day.
So as long as people have faith in the government, the value of the money is derived from that faith and trust in the government. For context, how do these cryptocurrencies, you know, differ from previous money technologies?
Well, before we had money, we had barter. So I had chickens and you had goats. And, you know, as long as you were hungry for goats and I was hungry for chickens, you know, we could swap three chickens to a goat or whatever, you know, ratio we wanted. But the problem was, you know, if you get lots of goats at the same time I get lots of chickens, you know, you're not hungry and I'm not hungry and nobody buys or sells anything. So the advantage of the first use of money in many ways was what's called a store of value, which means, you know, at the time you have excess goats or, you know, chickens, you can say, well, I've got more chickens than I need. I'll take fewer chickens and more dollars. Or, you know, puka shells or whatever the unit of money was. And I could do the same on my side. And then when I had, you know, when I was hungry and had dollars, I could turn the dollars back into food. So that's using money as a store of value. And that was one of the, you know, big innovations in human societies. And then from there, we progressed to what was called commodity money. This would be things like where there really is something like gold in the coin, and there's a dollar's worth of gold in the coin, or they used to have what they called silver certificates. Well, I guess that's actually a gold certificate or a silver certificate is what's something else that's called representative money, because clearly the piece of paper isn't made out of silver.
Right.
So that's a gold certificate. And then in some ways that's often called commodity-backed money because there's a commodity like gold or silver behind it. And then finally you get to the fiat money, which is what we were just talking about. And that really, it's the same as representative money. You just sort of take away the representation and say, as you said, it's the faith in the government that gives money the value, not the fact that you could turn it into gold, which you would use to make jewelry or something.
So what are the disadvantages of regular money, fiat money, in general, when compared to other things that are out there?
So, I should say as a disclaimer that pretty much all, disadvantages are relative, and they may not matter to you. To a lot of people, they look at what the government can do with fiat money, where the government can change the supply, and they say, well, that's manipulating the money supply. And I actually look at it and say, well, you know, if we have 10 countries on Earth and each country has their own money, there's going to be times in the politics of the whole country when I need to print more money to make my citizenry happy or to get reelected or to, fund hurricane relief or whatever. So I'm going to print money, and that devalues my currency relative to your currency. So that's I don't see money decisions, what are called monetary policy decisions, as, evil or maniacal governments out to hurt their people. But you certainly can point to cases in Zimbabwe, I think it was, where they got to the point where you literally needed a wheelbarrow to carry your, money to the store to buy a gallon of milk, because they had inflated the value of a dollar so much that the dollars weighed, it was giant chunks of, stacks of paper that were required to buy even the ordinary things of life. So, printing money can get out of hand. So that's the possibility of manipulation of the money supply, which happens with all regular money like we have today.
That's the government side of it. But what about the actual media itself, the failings or issues with the currency itself?
The physical money like we have is difficult to secure. I mean, there's always stories of people who put, money in a mattress to save it. They have to invent things like banks. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it is an enormous amount of money that goes into making more money, running the mint, printing bills, they wear out, and printing coins. It's expensive to produce money, currency and coins. And of course, anything that can be produced by the government can be produced by a counterfeiter. So you have the costs of counterfeiting. And finally, actual money that you touch is dirty and germy because it's been, touched and sneezed on by other people before it got to you. I mean, these aren't, pressing problems, but anytime you use a credit card to pay for something, you're avoiding all of these problems. Like, credit cards aren't as hard to secure, and they don't pay as much to produce them, and blah 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 blah. This is one of the reasons that cashless transactions are as popular now as they are.
So then, when we go to Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies, because they're a virtual currency, they've got other advantages. So why don't we go over some of those in comparison to the fiat money or the regular money we're all used to using?
Sure. So because virtual currencies are ledger-based, nothing actually changes hands. It's just two parallel changes in the ledger. So the ledger says, I have less money, Scott has more money, instead of me physically handing Scott a dollar bill. It's purely virtual. There are physical bitcoins that have been made, but really those were made as a stunt so that you could literally hand someone a bitcoin. The problem with that is that you have to print the private key on the bitcoin for it to have any value. And as soon as you print the private key on there, then it's sort of like a bearer bond. It's
right.
Whoever's holding it has the ability to spend it, and that probably isn't what you want.
Or I could sit down and copy the private key off it with a pen and paper and go do it somewhere else without the actual coin nearby.
Right.
It's almost worse than a bearer bond.
In many ways it is, because the you can hand that to the next guy and say, here it is, it's a whole Bitcoin, go spend it. And when he tries to, he finds out you've already spent it because, you had the private key. So, there's all those problems that come in when you try and make something that's inherently virtual into a physical object. Another thing to think about is that, all of these blockchain currencies, cryptocurrencies, are independent of governments. So far, there is no government who's said, we're tired of spending all that money on the mint. we think it'd be better to invent the local Bitcoin currency for our citizenry. Hasn't happened yet. It certainly could happen someday. I don't think it's too likely. But the key point is that the cryptocurrencies can continue to exist without a government there to give them value. And because they aren't tied to one particular government, as, dollars and yen are tied, they're inherently international. So the Bitcoin in Japan is the same as the Bitcoin in the U.S. And in effect, a, a Bitcoin can be sent, if you will, from Japan to America, from a wallet in Japan to a wallet in America without paying any sort of taxation at the border. And that's a very important advantage to people who do a lot of international transactions. I can tell you, when our company had employees, even just in London, the amount of, you know, money we had to send to London, you know, to get money in their bank account was far higher than what the employees actually received by the time we got through all the foreign exchange rigmarole. It's very expensive to send money across government borders.
So it might have been better to just pay them in Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, that's happening at a lot of Bitcoin startups. They're just paid in Bitcoin. You in some ways that shifts the burden, because then the employee now has to figure out how to get it turned back into money they can spend at the local gas station or utility company, and then they probably pay tax on it then. But hopefully they still pay less tax than they would if they went through the normal mechanism where the money changers collect it. The last thing that I think is different in an important way about cryptocurrencies is that we mentioned manipulation before, or the changes in supply at the will of the government. With cryptocurrencies, at least in the Bitcoin case, the existence of Bitcoins and the production of new Bitcoins, the mining rate is all fixed. And we touched on that briefly before, but the net effect is that if you just know what year and day it is, you know how many Bitcoin there are on Earth. And that's true for the past, and that's true for the future. So we don't have an Alan Greenspan, or I guess it's Janet Yellen. We don't have government bureaucrats, sounds negative, but I mean, we don't have government agencies who look over the amount of Bitcoin and say, you know, crank up the printing presses, we'll make more, or hold some back because it would be better for our foreign policy or our domestic policy. We just have more Bitcoins at a rate which is known for all. And that means that's both good and bad. It means that if there were a country using Bitcoin for their local supply and they desperately needed to have more money because of hurricane relief or whatever, there's no knob they can turn to make more Bitcoin in Puerto Rico. But it also means that, you know, an evil government can't inflate away the value of your cash that you're holding. So it's just a property of these things.
So you mentioned before about the predictable generation rate. We talked about this in a previous podcast. It was basically 10 minutes between the generations of Bitcoin. You mentioned at one point that there's actually a correction that occurs every 4 years.
Yeah, that's really the only part we didn't go into in any depth. But what it boils down to is the actual number of Bitcoins produced would grow forever if there'd be no end to the production. And the designers of Bitcoin wanted it to behave a bit more like a commodity, like gold. Not a commodity like chickens, where you can always grow more chickens. But if you think about, you know, the Earth's crust, there's only so much gold in the Earth's crust, and people have had very strong incentives to search the Earth's crust to find any gold that was just laying around and they could pick it up and walk away. And then they had incentives to dig deeper and look for gold, and deeper mines, and, you know, more and more technology for extracting the gold. And, you know, at some point, though, the production rate of gold will decline, and the designers of Bitcoin wanted to have that same sort of decline. So every 4 years, the rate of producing Bitcoins falls in half. So it started out that every 10 minutes, they made 50 Bitcoins, and that was good for the first 4 years. And then every 10 minutes, they make 25 Bitcoins. And now we're down to 12 and a half Bitcoins every, or I guess it'll soon shift over. I've forgotten when the shift is or was. But because it's halving, it's sort of an asymptotic curve. And I think in 2140, the last one will be mined. There's 21 million of them.
Okay.
About 16 million today.
So we've got about 16 million today, and you said there'll be about 21 million total.
Yep.
And then each one of those Bitcoins obviously can be fractioned up, because, you know, you're not going to necessarily spend a whole Bitcoin to buy, you know, a loaf of bread.
Well, hopefully, you know, when they were worth less than a dollar, there was a guy who bought two pepperoni pizzas for 10,000 Bitcoins in the very early days, you know, when they were essentially worthless. So it has changed. But no, you're right, Scott. That's a key point, that each Bitcoin is divisible, and it's divisible into 100 million pieces. Each of those pieces is called a Satoshi. And I did a little bit of math and figured out that the gross world product is about $100 trillion. And so it basically works out that you could represent the gross product of the world in pennies with bitcoins. So okay. We don't have to worry that they're not divisible enough. We'll always be able to subdivide a bitcoin to make the equivalent of a penny. Unless we want to start paying micro pennies, then we have to worry about micro satoshis or something. $10 still gets in just fine.
Why is the price of Bitcoin so volatile?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of factors. Let's rule one out. We touched on this, but it's important. Because the supply is known, it can't be that people are making Bitcoins too fast or not making them fast enough. So what that means is any change in the price is driven by a change in demand, not by a change in supply. So the changes in demand are due to people's perceptions of the value. So a great example was years ago when the Cypriots were planning their independence from Greece or something like that. And, you know, if you look at the price history of Bitcoin, in many cases, the spikes are driven by, I don't want to say political unrest, but, well, in many cases, it's sort of global fear about the stability of the money. So, and this gets back to what is money good for, right? And so if the reason you're holding your local currency is because you had too many goats in the past and you sold the goats for money and, you know, now you're ready to, you know, use that money to buy something of value. And, you know, if it's worth far less now than when you sold the goats, you know, then you're sort of angry at your government. You feel cheated because you would have been better to just hang on to the goats or something like that. You know, pay for the food to hold the goats and then sell them later. And because, frankly, you get more money for the goats because the money is worth less now. It gets messy whenever there's a government who needs to or wants to change the way money works in their country or the way money works at the border between their country and some other. So those pressures tend to make Bitcoin more valuable. The pressures that tend to make it less valuable are regulatory actions where, like, New York imposed a bit license at one point, and I think that probably reduced the cost some because it makes it harder to do a startup company. Or can't think of other things that decrease the value. But, oh, well, we had a Jamie
Dimon. How about China? A few weeks ago?
Yeah, that was a good case where the price went down. So I guess China said no ICO, no what particular type of Bitcoin contract couldn't be used in China anymore. And China has varied a lot on their policy, and that is a fairly large area of interest. There's a lot of Chinese who are interested in Bitcoin, and that is because the Chinese have been changing their monetary policy, and people who are trying to get money in and out of China or who are trying to store the value of their goats or chickens in, you know, they're a little nervous about storing it in renminbi, a local currency, and would rather maybe store it in Bitcoin. And then, of course, there's just speculators. And this is true in any market. You can speculate on a rising price of, you know, goat futures or chicken futures or McDonald's stock or General Motors or, you know,
or
whatever it is.
Bitcoin.
Or the value of Bitcoin. So speculators can pump the value up by buying it or deflate the value by selling it. So there's a lot of pressures in there. And I guess the final one is that if you look at developed markets, you know, not only is there a cash price for, I'm going to switch from goats to like pork bellies, right? Because that's a commodity some people have heard of. If you have a bag of dollar bills and want to buy pork bellies today, there's a price that you can do that for. But also you can say, you know, I'm Hormel and I'm going to be making bacon in 3 months and I want to lock in the price of pork bellies 3 months from now. You can buy a contract which guarantees you the right to buy pork bellies in the future for, I don't want to say today's price, but it's a price with some risk removed. And that's called a futures contract, an options contract. So Bitcoin does not yet have that ability. The markets don't yet exist. At least they aren't well developed for making bets on future value. And those bets on the future value have the effect of reducing the volatility because you hopefully have a group of speculators on both sides, you know, gleefully rubbing their hands together saying, oh, I know this baby's going up, right? And they're betting on that. And there's people say, oh, this thing is worthless. It's going to explode. I'm betting it's going to go down. And they're willing to take risk. to do
so
that.
Right now, if I want to bet on Bitcoin, I essentially have to buy Bitcoin.
That's the best way to do it. There are exchanges. I think there's one called GDAX or something where you can make a futures bet. But as I said, they certainly aren't well developed and they aren't regulated. And I, you know, the farther the bet is away from today, probably the more risk you're taking. The exchange won't be there, or I don't know, you don't even know how you collect. I've never dabbled in that.
So let's go into the mechanics of Bitcoin. If I want to accept Bitcoin from somebody, I need a wallet. Right. What is a wallet? How does a wallet actually work, or a Bitcoin wallet actually work?
Well, there's a bunch of things that a wallet does. Some are analogous to a wallet you'd use every day to hold your dollar bills. A key thing that a Bitcoin wallet does for you is it is a way to secure your private key. So your actual private key is, well, I've forgotten, it's got to be 40 to 50 hexadecimal characters, you know, impossible to remember. For any brain I know couldn't remember that. But you often will unlock your private key with a passphrase that you can remember, you know, something unique to you. Think of it like a password. So a wallet is a way to store your private key. And then when you're ready to use your private key to sign a transaction, which is when you're spending money, then your wallet will respond to your passphrase by signing the transaction and then sending it off to the blockchain. And that's how you spend Bitcoin. And that's how transactions get submitted to the miners, who then combine those transactions and extend the chain. And the other key thing is you have to remember that every transaction in Bitcoin is kept in every node forever and ever and ever, like we said. So if I want to know my balance, I could go through the entire history of all transactions and say, oh, that one's not mine, that one's not mine, that one's not mine, because they've only made, you know, a few dozen transactions. It's very inefficient to go through every transaction and find the ones that are yours. So a wallet keeps a local copy of your transaction history. And it does, of course, make sure that it is synced up with the actual blockchain every time you turn the wallet software on to make sure nothing has changed while the wallet was asleep. But you can look in your wallet and know what your balance is, much like you'd look at your bank or your bank statement for a balance. And wallets can be implemented as a website you go to, like Coinbase has a wallet, or a blockchain.io has a website, or it can be an app running on your smartphone. And even a wallet can be a paper wallet. This is akin to the metal Bitcoin that I mentioned before, where you sort of have to print the private key on a piece of paper. So it is one way to physically hand someone Bitcoin, is to hand them this thing called a paper wallet. But that just has the private key there for all to see if you let anyone see it.
Now, they also sell USB keys that are wallets as well, right?
Yes, yes. You can buy what's called a hardware wallet. And those are really sort of a fancy way. Some of them have displays and let you, you know, like little simple user interfaces with scroll up and scroll down sort of things. And you can use that. Some of them are really just tokens that enable the software on a PC or a Mac to actually spend as long as the token is plugged in, but then the software shuts down as soon as the token is unplugged. So it's a simple thing to secure. You can put one on your keychain. You can put it in the safety deposit box at the bank. And sometimes you'll hear the term cold wallet, meaning that it's a wallet which is stored offline. It isn't on the internet anywhere. So the money just literally cannot be spent unless that device is plugged into a computer.
So what do you do?
Well, I have a variety of things because I don't want to put all my eggs in any one basket. So I have a couple of websites where I have some sitting here in the little machine in my office, and some sitting at Coinbase. So I guess there's at least three wallets I can think of that are distributed around the internet.
So you're not storing goats company. Or anything like that?
No livestock. they're just my favorite example.
So let's revisit the miners. How do the miners actually make money?
So I mentioned in the past that what they're doing is solving these complex puzzles, and that's what the difficulty of solving that puzzle is what makes it hard to go back and change history, which is why there's effectively no eraser for the transaction history. So in effect, miners get paid for solving this difficult puzzle. And that, as we mentioned, that income diminishes over time. Every 4 years that you make a little less money mining. So there has to be another way for miners to get paid, and that's actually from the transaction fees. So if I send, you know, $100 to a friend in Tokyo, they don't get $100, but they do get like $99.20 last time I checked or something like that. And if you compare that 80 cents on a $100 tax to what Western Union would charge or what, Citibank would charge to move $100 to Tokyo, it's night and day difference. You'd be looking at like, $4 or $5 or $8 to pay for Western Union or a money order or some of these other competing schemes for moving money around the earth. So those are the sources of income that you have when you're mining. Is you get paid for the transactions and you get paid for extending the block when you win. And then you have these costs that you have to look at on the mining side, because you're spending money to buy power and expenses and all these things. And the things you buy, you have to buy with dollars. Right. So you're paying the power company in U.S. dollars. The power company doesn't want your bitcoins. So if you're mining successfully, you're bringing in bitcoin, but you also have to sell some fraction of what you mine to pay back the costs of the equipment you buy or the energy you use or, the warehouse where you run your equipment or whatever it might be, the data center. So you really have those key costs. You're making money from the actual mining work, from the transaction fees, and then you're spending money to keep the lights on, essentially.
So, should I go out and drop a grand on a mining rig and get started mining today? I mean, is this something worth doing or considering?
I'd say no. It's probably too late and too complicated. And in my case, I decided it had too much ongoing work, so I stopped. But my son pointed out to me, too, that historically, if you were in early enough, you would have been much better off to just take, money and buy Bitcoin on an exchange from pretty much the day the Bitcoin exchanges started. You were better off to buy Bitcoin with dollars and just hold that Bitcoin until today, as opposed to going through all the rigmarole of, mining and all the stuff that we did. But that's really good in some ways, a consequence of the earliness which we got in there. I'll say that I'm very glad I did the mining, because I learned a lot and had a lot of fun. And, I kind of feel like I was in on the leading edge of something. And those are, emotionally nice things. But in retrospect, I probably should have just bought Bitcoin and held it. I think that's still good advice for today, because as you point out, it's volatile. So, buying Bitcoin is not good store of value, especially if you're looking in the short term. It's within days, it's been up and down, 20% at times. So, if your investment horizon is longer than days, maybe it makes a little more sense. But it's smart people I know have said essentially that they see the future value of Bitcoin as a what's called a binary option, meaning that either the future value of Bitcoin will be, $50,000 instead of $4,000 like it is today, or it'll be zero. It's they don't think there's a lot of case for it to muddle along kind of where it is now. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I don't think it would be the mining game is competitive in a way that I find it doesn't suit me. If you're into that kind of competition, try it. But boy, it doesn't seem to make economic sense.
So like traditional fiat currencies, can Bitcoin be lost or destroyed?
Yes, it certainly can. So, in the same way that you can lose your wallet, it's happened to me, you can lose your private key, your passphrase. You can forget your passphrase. Or, the hard drive on which you store your private key can explode and you don't have a backup. And in these cases, these are effectively Bitcoins that can't be spent. They're in the ledger. Everyone can see that they're still there in the ledger, and it's frustrating. You can look at it and see that your Bitcoins are still there. You just can't spend them if you've lost the key. So it is in many ways analogous to, watching a dollar fall into the sewer grate and float away down the stream or whatever. Or throwing coins in a fountain. It's just money that's gone. And in the same way that you can burn a dollar bill or melt a coin or something, you can destroy a Bitcoin by, in effect, transferring it to a random address for which the public key is unknown. There's billions and billions, maybe hundreds of billions of addresses. And if you just randomly pick one and send your Bitcoin there, there's no getting it back. So it very much like cash, it can disappear.
So if it's very much like cash, can they be counterfeited?
Not really. You can't counterfeit it and still call it a Bitcoin or tell people that it is a Bitcoin, because in effect, each of the nodes, each of the miners knows what the rules of Bitcoin are. And as soon as anybody tries anything funky, they go, I'm not taking that as a valid transaction. So a Bitcoin is really defined as much as anything else by the rules of Bitcoin transaction log keeping, by the blockchain itself. So you can still start a thing called Scottcoin if you want and have different rules. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing that prevents you from doing that. It's just not Bitcoin.
It wouldn't have the same trust and faith, so it probably wouldn't be worth a whole lot.
You could earn it over time, right? And there are, you know, you can look, there's websites that are just devoted to the different varieties of currency. And, you know, it's really not hard to, because it's all open source software, it's really not hard to sort of take this open source software and replace the word bit with the word Scott and say, now I've got Scott coins. But no, essentially you're fighting a social problem, which is to persuade people to work hard today on the promise of value into the future.
So maybe I need Kardashian coins or something.
There you go. Yes. There you go. Yes. Why not? Yeah. Pick a social thing, a Twitter coin or something, Facebook coin.
So are Bitcoins safe to use?
Yes. I'd say that the only way I'd qualify it is that, as with anything where there's a computer involved, malware is a possibility. And, you know, you can get malware from going to a dodgy website. And recently, Showtime, in fact, I wouldn't call them a dodgy website, but bad guys got into Showtime's website and set up software that would be downloaded to your computer whenever you watched a movie on Showtime. And what that software did was it mined Bitcoins using the CPU of your computer or the GPU of your computer while you were watching Showtime movies. So that was an accident, in effect, on Showtime's part, but it shows that the bad guys are out there trying to figure out how to use your computer or your internet to do mining work for them, although it's very slow and doesn't pay much. If they can convince a million people to do it, maybe it adds up. And of course, the big attraction for them is that if they do succeed and manage to get some cryptocurrency by sneaking stuff onto your computer, they can sneak the money off, spend it wherever they are with no trace that, you know, who they are. Right. So they can maintain their anonymity as they're stealing stuff from you. The other aspect of this is that Bitcoin gets used for what's called ransomware. So this really doesn't make Bitcoin unsafe to use, but it points out the anonymity, like I just mentioned. There are bad guys who have discovered that people care a lot about the files on their computers. And if they can sneak their malware onto your computer and encrypt all of your files in a way that makes them useless to you, then they can say, well, you know, bad things do happen to nice people, and we'd be happy to put those files back just the way they were if only you would send us some Bitcoin. And that's the ransom they demand to put your files back the way they were. So, you know, the danger here is not with Bitcoin itself. Bitcoin's the vehicle used to pay anonymously the person who's holding your data hostage, and you're better off to try and avoid getting the ransomed in the first place. And the simplest defense against things like that is just to have a backup. So if you catch the bad software on Tuesday, you just roll back to your Monday data and don't visit the dodgy website, and you'll never be ransomed for the Bitcoin.
So Bitcoin is almost getting that negative connotation just by association, because it's an anonymous currency that's used to pay for these types of illicit activities.
That's it, yeah. And so it's a toxic combination. When you put malicious people together with anonymous currencies, then they go, what can we ransom today? And your data is an obvious thing.
So now, if I have some Bitcoin and I have it sitting around at a Bitcoin exchange, is that a good idea, or should I move the stuff out of an exchange and put it into my wallet?
I would recommend you keep control of it, because if you look at where Bitcoin has gone missing, or where people have lost their Bitcoin, it's been in exchanges. There was a famous one in Japan called Mount Gox, G-O-X, that blew up. And it's still unknown if they, in effect, lost the Bitcoin through incompetence or malice. But all we know is that it's gone. And in effect, the reason this is possible is that in order to sell Bitcoin through an exchange and get, you know, yen or dollars or whatever it is you want resulting sale, you have to transfer your Bitcoin from your wallet to a proxy wallet at the exchange and give the exchange the authority to spend from that wallet. And then if you buy Bitcoin, then it's sort of natural for you to let your bought Bitcoin sit there in that exchange Exchange wallet, proxy wallet for a while. And they encourage that because, you know, of course, that lets you sell it in the future or whatever else you want to do. But then the danger is while it's sitting there in that wallet, it could get compromised. That would be unsafe. But other than those three things, I'd say Bitcoin's, you know, perfectly safe. And in the same way that cash, you know, cash has these hazards, U.S. dollars have these hazards. You have to know about the hazards of using Bitcoin, but it's inherently safe technology.
How about the legality of it? Is Bitcoin legal in the U.S.? I mean, what are the legal issues around it?
It's very legal. There was some question at the beginning, but not much, because if you go back through the history of money law, I guess you'd call it, I'm not an expert in these areas, but if you look at, there's a chain that recently filed for bankruptcy called Toys R Us, and they have things called Jeffrey dollars, and these were things where, you know, you'd, for every $100 you spent, they'd give you one Jeffrey dollar or whatever, and you could redeem them later. And so this is, you know, if you bought enough stuffed animals, you know, you could save your Jeffrey dollars and go back to Toys R Us and give them a stack of their Jeffrey dollars and get one more stuffed animal.
Not unlike frequent flyer miles.
In many ways, yes. Frequent flyer miles are a good analogy. And there have been many of these. Gift cards are another thing, right? So the government does not want to say that the only store of value is the U.S. dollar. The government, in fact, explicitly allows you to store value in, you know, goats and chickens, as we've said, but also in Jeffrey dollars or frequent flyer miles. And any of the airlines are happy to take cash and turn them into more miles, or miles and turn them into more cash. I've never seen that be a good deal, but they'll always do it for you. So yes, they're legal, and you just have to use the dollars to pay your tax. That's the little asterisk you throw on there.
How about other countries? Are there do we have kind of a high level view of what it's like in other countries?
Yeah. So especially following some of the money troubles that happen in Africa. There's a few African countries, Kenya and Tanzania, where effectively virtual currencies paved the way. And it's kind of a interesting the way it got started. You know, these are famous places in the telecoms world because they never had landline telephone service. And cellular service came in as the first telephone service there. And it turned out to be one of the things that, you know, people needed to pay for was minutes on their cellular phones. And so just like frequent flyer miles or Jeffrey dollars, you can think of your account at the cell phone carrier, if you're prepaid anyway, you can think of your account as having a balance, like you've got, you know, 500 minutes left to talk this month. And you can take dollars and get it up to 1,000 minutes left this month, right? Or maybe if you have more minutes than you need, you can get to the end of the month and sell your leftover minutes to the guy next door. So in many ways, a balance of unused prepaid minutes at a cell phone carrier is a lot like a balance at a bank account. And the cellular carriers in Kenya sort of put their thinking caps on and realized, hey, we can make money like this. We just use cellular minutes as a form of currency. So literally you can take your little flip phone and walk into a store and use cellular minutes to buy eggs or milk. And the cellular carriers are behaving as banks in these countries, and it's a digital currency. And the governments don't seem to mind this. And, of course, there's limits on it. You don't walk around with a billion cellular minutes. But it's quite functional as a currency.
So now going back to countries themselves, and do, you know, countries like the U.S. and others try to regulate Bitcoin in any sort of way?
Well, they'd sure like to. But, you know, by definition, if you want to regulate a currency, it has to be your currency. You know, so the U.S. government can regulate U.S. dollars, but the U.S. government has no control over Bitcoin. They're going to be produced when they're produced. They'll be spent when they're spent, and the government doesn't have anything to say about that. So it isn't quite correct to say that there's no room to regulate it, but there's nothing in the guts of Bitcoin that can be regulated. So where Bitcoin does get wrapped up with government regulation is at the edges of Bitcoin. Point, right? Where Bitcoin stops and dollars start, or Bitcoin stops and yen start, right? So it's at the exchanges where Bitcoin gets turned into fiat currency. That's where the regulation happens, and that's where you get into the In the U.S., the banks are all, or the exchanges are required to go through like getting a copy of your driver's license and bank account number, so they know who's buying and selling the Bitcoin.
Right. So how is Bitcoin taxed in the U.S. as an example?
Yeah, well, I'll put a disclaimer on and say I'm no CPA. Well, I guess I'll also add that the Bitcoin I sold, I reported as ordinary income. I know from reading recently that if you are, as you mentioned, if you're an employee who's paid in Bitcoin, you still have to report your earnings to the government with dollar equivalents, right? And the government expects to be paid their tax on earnings, whether you were handed a Bitcoin at the end of your hard labor or handed a dollar. They just want the units reported in dollars. But Bitcoins also have this unusual property that they can be held as an asset, unlike a dollar. I mean, if you take a dollar in 1970 and put it away for, 30 years and then come out in 2000 with that same dollar, it's actually probably worth less because of inflation and the government's, happy, but it is still a dollar. So there's no change in the value. It's just a dollar. It's maybe less you can buy with it. So there's, Bitcoins are different because, if you, as I recommended, instead of mining, if you were to go out, spend $100 to buy Bitcoin today, and then in 5 years, if it's worth, $1,000, well, you've had a $900 gain on the holding that asset for 5 years, and that's a capital gains tax. So you're subject to capital gains and a loss. I suppose you could deduct it if you, spend $1,000 in Bitcoin today and sold it for $100 because of the value. You dropped. I think that's a $900 loss. And finally, miners are now required to report their income when they mine bitcoins today.
Not unlike gamblers, right? That have to report their winnings.
Yep.
Right. So it's just another form of currency. So we hear a lot about online drug dealers and people doing things where they're using Bitcoin, whether they're laundering money or whatever, they're using Bitcoin to do that. What's the concept behind why they would use Bitcoin?
Well, it's probably the anonymity. I can't remember that. Oh, was it Wolf of Wall Street? I think was the name of a movie I saw where they, the guy was making so much money in the U.S., he was trying to sneak it out of the country, and he would be going through customs, entering other countries with, stacks of bills, taped to his body, and under his clothes, trying to sneak through, because there's limits to how much currency you're allowed to carry. So the Bitcoin is, because it's virtual and not physical, doesn't weigh anything. The advantage is you can send it across. Customs doesn't know if you're moving money in or out of the country. But anonymity is a big thing as well. If I wanted to buy illicit drugs, or if I wanted to hire a contract murderer or something like that, the best way to pay a hitman to do a murder for me would be to use what they call a briefcase full of Benjamins, right? So if you get a briefcase and you fill it up with $100 bills, you hand that to the hitman after he bumps off your enemy or whatever. And now the hitman has in this briefcase money he can spend. He will be looked at strangely if he walks into a bank with a briefcase full of Benjamins and says, please put this in my account, because the bank is told, or the government has told the bank, watch out for guys with a briefcase full of money because they might be hitmen. I want you to fill out a form whenever a guy like that walks in the door. That's called a suspicious activity report. So, U.S. dollars do get used to pay for drugs and murders and all kinds of illicit things because literally U.S. dollars have that property of anonymity. Now, Bitcoin also has something, it's not quite anonymous. Pseudonymous is the fancy name. It means if you don't tell anyone that a given public key goes with your name, then nobody knows who it goes with, which is one of the reasons why we don't know anything about Satoshi, because there's a public key that goes with him, but we don't know which human that goes with. There is room for using any anonymous form of money to bad ends, with drugs or whatever, but it's the same whether it's anonymous cash or anonymous virtual currency.
So I could take a wallet, put half a dozen bitcoins in it, and then literally take the wallet, hand the private key or the wallet itself over to somebody else, and say, "Here, this is now yours. Do this thing for me that I asked you to do.
Right.
And I've paid them in a currency that's a lot harder to track.
Well, cash is not easy to track, right? It all comes to size, right? Which is the limits are $10,000, something like that, on the suspicious activity report.
So it's $10,000.
Yeah. So, you know, we had a local politician who, made a series of $9,999 withdrawals from his bank account. You know, and so even though that's the limit, I think the bank still filled out suspicious activity reports on him, or eventually the FBI got their hands on his account statements. But so the point is, it's because the government has the banks watching for suspicious transactions, you know, when the amount of money moving is large enough, then, you know, it raises these suspicions. That's just the way it works, rather the money being moved. And so, again, all the government can watch is at the bank side or the exchange side. They can't watch the Bitcoin wallets. I mean, they certainly can see that I paid you $1 million in Bitcoin, but they don't know if that's because you murdered someone for me or you sang me a song, you know, and I really valued the song you sang. You know, they just don't know.
Right. And they wouldn't even know it was me if they didn't have any path back to my private key.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
You know, so obviously Bitcoin's used, you know, for money laundering. It can be used for illicit things. What else is it used for outside of the obvious things we've talked about?
I'll go through a few, but let me mention briefly the relative uses, because a key question is if you say that, you know, there's 100 Bitcoin transactions and some of them were used for drugs and some of them were used for buying music or singing a song or something, you know,
buying goats.
Goats are something, you know, worthy, a noble human endeavor, as opposed to something negative like drugs or contract murder. The question is how much of Bitcoin is illicit traffic. And the answer is very, very little. It is the marquee thing that people think about. But the government had concerns about the use of Bitcoin for illicit transactions. And it was no secret that the place on actually it wasn't on the internet. It wasn't on the web. It was the dark web. It's called, there was a place called Silk Road, which was a marketplace where you could buy any kind of recreational drug. There were rumors that you could buy contract murders on there and all kinds of illicit things. And the government found that place. It was clearly the premier venue for buying and selling illicit things, and the government shut it down. And of course, there was a regular rate of Bitcoin transactions up to that point of the shutdown per day, and there was a rate afterwards. And it's hard to look back in history and even see the date when that happened. It was October 2013. I just looked at the data today, and you don't see much of a blip at all, which says to me that the vast majority of Bitcoin transactions are not contract murders and illicit drugs. They're, you know, like you say, goats and chickens. And I actually think the majority of it is me having family in another place and sending money back to my family. It's avoiding the money which would normally go to Western Union or Citibank or whoever does the international money transfers. That's where I think it is. And there's speculators are probably in there too. So there's a certain amount of speculation that goes on. So Bitcoin has lots of people who are hoping the value goes up. There's probably some people who are betting the value goes down. But each of those is a source of transactions.
It's easier to send them Bitcoin than to send them a goat.
Maybe. Yes, sure is.
How does one go about buying and selling Bitcoins?
Well, as you mentioned, you have to get one of these wallet things first, which is free. It's just you go to a website or download some software from the App Store. And then there are Bitcoin ATMs in any big city, you know, Chicago. In fact, I did a presentation on Bitcoin for my company, which is an office, you know, right in downtown Chicago. And I just, as an exercise, I went and said, you know, find the Bitcoin ATM closest to my office. And it was 0.2 mile away. Now, there's a Citibank ATM in the lobby of my building. I don't even have to go outside. So Bitcoin ATMs are not as common as regular old U.S. dollar ATMs. But, you know, beyond that one, there were like, I want to say, a dozen Bitcoin ATMs within a couple miles of my office in downtown Chicago, maybe just a mile or so. So they're out there. So you can, once you have a wallet, you can go to an ATM and put, you know, $20 bills into the ATM and get Bitcoin showing up in your wallet. There's also websites you can go to. I mentioned Coinbase. Coinbase.com is a good exchange. And you give them your bank account number and they send a couple of small transactions to make sure it's you. and you give them a photocopy of your driver's license, and then away you go. And I mentioned blockchain.info is a good place to get one of these wallets. And off you, you're ready to buy and hold Bitcoin.
What are hard forks?
Yeah, it doesn't. So a hard fork is it goes back to the question you were asking about, can you make your own Bitcoin? And there was a case recently where a group of people who had been Bitcoin miners said, we don't like something about Bitcoin. We don't like the rules of Bitcoin. Specifically, they didn't like the fact that Bitcoin can't handle more than about 3 transactions per second. And that may sound like a lot, 3 transactions per second, but if you think about, the number of transactions per second that Visa and MasterCard are doing, at peak shopping hours, it's a drop in the bucket. So they wanted to create something like Bitcoin, but that could handle, thousands of transactions per second. And so they took the basic Bitcoin software and said, we like the history you guys have. We like the ledger system. We like everything except a few numbers. And they just changed a few numbers that let it do transactions faster and called it Bitcoin Cash instead of regular Bitcoin. And that was called a hard fork because up to the point where they started their alternative currency, there's a shared blockchain, but the blockchain splits in two at the time they started up their network. And a miner had to decide if they were going to keep mining on the regular Bitcoin blockchain or move over to this Bitcoin Cash blockchain. And so that was an interesting experiment. It's still going on. And it's one of the ways to innovate with new cryptocurrencies is to do this sort of hard fork thing.
So how about any final thoughts or notes on Bitcoin that you want to just fit in fit in any old place?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of people who ask me about Bitcoin and with almost a worried tone in their voice. And I look at Bitcoin as an advancement in technology. It's a new money technology. And in the same way that, puka shells were better than bartering goats for chickens and, currencies, were invented, Bitcoin is just the latest invention in money technology. And I think people will keep inventing all kinds of new technologies that as long as they solve problems. There's a lot of technologies have been invented and then never applied. But if you look at the history of Bitcoin, people have been continuously applying it. And in fact, a very interesting point to me was that the value of Bitcoin is correlated with the square of the number of unique people doing Bitcoin transactions in a day. So this is what's called Metcalfe's law, something you certainly know about on the solar flare side. The value of a network is proportional to the square of the number of nodes on the network. And there's new research which has shown that the value of a Bitcoin is proportional to the square of the number of people using Bitcoin in a given day. So that's one of the things which may have accounted for some of the rise in the value of a Bitcoin. So, I would say that an economist might call Bitcoins today a pretty good medium of exchange, meaning that, it's better than swapping goats for chickens. But I think an economist would also say that Bitcoin's not a very good store of value because of the volatility you mentioned. So that's it in a nutshell.
Interesting. So if we took the 3 transactions per second and then we took the square of that, that would almost give us some idea of the value.
It's not the
unique number of people that have used it, but it probably could be tied back statistically to a unique number of people.
Yes, and it has maxed out. We're at the years ago we hit the 3 transaction per second rate, and it's staying there. And it, in fact, it used to be transactions were literally free, and the reason you have to pay for a transaction today is because in order to get in to the 3 transactions per second limit, you have to pay to get in there. And there just aren't enough to go around for people who are trying to spend, micro cents, but, $10 still gets in just fine.
This is Scott Schweitzer, the technology evangelist, and I'd like to provide a special thanks to Bob Van Valza for lending his expertise on blockchains and bitcoins to further clarify this for us. Several things have changed since Bob and I first recorded the initial half of these episodes on digital currencies back on September 14th, and I'd like to address those now. When we started this series on Bitcoin, it was trading around 3,000. And this week, December 8th, it passed $18,000 US dollars for the first time. It's amazing to see that average people are now interested in this aspect of technology. Beyond their smartphones, most people don't care how things work. Regular folks are asking, what is this Bitcoin thing? We've addressed much of this in the prior six parts of this podcast, but let me hopefully dispel the most common myth that Bitcoin isn't real. I'm asked, or in fact told by people, that Bitcoin isn't real, and the primary argument is that we can't touch it. There's no physical currency. I then ask, when was the last time you were actually paid in physical currency? Our paychecks are direct deposited, and we use credit cards and contactless payment systems all the time. Actual currency for normal day-to-day transactions has gone out of vogue. If someone's uncomfortable with the realness of Bitcoin, they can go to select Bitcoin ATMs and turn their Bitcoin into U.S. currency certificates nearly as easily as using a regular ATM. So Bitcoin is just as real as U.S. currency. They just don't waste the time or resources printing out actual currency certificates. Suppose I'd obtained a bearer bond from a bank for $120,000 back on September 14th. I could have presented it to you then just as easily as I could have created a digital wallet worth $120,000 in Bitcoin and then printed out that private key and the instructions and presented that piece of paper to you. Both are small, finite paper documents, not unlike actual U.S. currency, but with a promise value of $120,000. At that point in time, both documents were also worth 100,000 euros, and both were highly volatile. A single match could destroy both documents, forever eliminating that value from the world. By December 8th, that bearer bond for $120,000 had increased in value from 100,000 euros to 102,000 euros, further proving that the value of U.S. currency isn't fixed. But more importantly, the Bitcoin wallet is now worth 470,000 euros. Which would you rather have? If that's not real enough, two of the U.S.'s biggest derivative markets will begin trading on Bitcoin. This week, CBOE, on Sunday night, December 10th, will begin accepting contracts. And on December 18th, CME will begin taking futures contracts. Some believe this might aid in stabilizing the currency. We hope you've enjoyed this series on digital currencies and Bitcoin. Please stay tuned. Our next series is on security, starting later this month.